that made me.
Now picture the scene. It is high summer, January 1985. Hawke and Keating are running the country. And a young farmer from northern New South Wales is sitting in a room with a banker from the Commonwealth Bank. And by the end of the meeting, he's been convinced, or he has convinced himself, to take out a newfangled sort of financial instrument. It's going to be a foreign currency loan, as it happens, in Swiss francs. And he's doing it because he believes that some property investments will give him and his family a bit more security in their future. Well, you can probably tell where all this is heading. It all comes unstuck. The Aussie dollar crashes, the foreign loan becomes pretty much unserviceable, and for 10 years, that young farmer, let's call him John, goes through the courts up against the biggest financial institution in the country. And at the end of it all, John and the family lose the farm. And with that, John might reasonably have been expected to disappear into rural obscurity. Bit of shearing, bit of truck driving maybe, and a fair bit of drowning his sorrows down at the pub. Except it didn't quite end that way. Senator John Williams joins us now for the year that made me. Good morning.
Good morning, Hugh.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well, given the last couple of weeks in Parliament, if I can put it that way.
It has been a little crazy, hasn't it?
Very crazy.
So what happens? What's happening in Parliament at the moment? We've got all kinds of, you know, rumours are travelling the land, promises to reveal rumours, people calling each other members of the Hitler Youth. You've got the leader of your own party disappearing. What's going on?
I think what we're doing in Parliament is adding to the perception of the public that, look, stop your mucking about, stop your yapping, stop your slander and get on with the job of running the country. And the clear message I'm getting, Hugh, is that, you know, you're paid to do a job, get on with that and focus on the real important things, the things that really matter to the people of Australia.
Barnaby Joyce is a mate of yours and a long-time mate of yours. Is he going to get back to the leadership, do you think?
Oh, look, only time would tell that, Hugh. I'd have to look into the crystal ball and I simply couldn't say. He's a very capable man. Sadly, he's not there anymore, but that's life in politics.
Because his kind of, you know, that sort of bullish bloke stuff resonates, doesn't it, up your way?
Oh, he's terrific at selling a message. Last election, July the 2nd last year, Hugh, the Liberals lost a lot of seats. The Nationals kept all of our seats and won off the Liberals because we had a good front runner, a good salesman who could sell a message in Barnaby Joyce. And I think Barnaby's still got a lot to contribute to our country, and I wish him well in the future.
Do you regret, particularly as a bush politician, as a regional Australia politician, do you regret, you know, the necessity in some ways for politicians to become suited technocrats a bit more than that sort of authentic voice of the bush?
Yeah, I do. I think the big thing when you're in politics, just be yourself. Speak your mind, be honest, don't tell lies. And probably the most important thing in politics, if you promise something, Hugh, you must honour that promise. If you don't, people simply lose trust in you.
Mm. Now, everyone, I'm calling you John, but everyone, friends and enemies and constituents, they call you Whacker.
Yep.
Where does Whacker come from?
I was born in 1955. I grew up at first 5 years of my life at Yongala, a little place in South Australia between Jamestown and Peterborough, where my great-great-grandfather settled with his wife, Catherine. And we lived on the farm for 5 years, and my mum would bath me of an evening, and she'd say, right, I run down to the bedroom to get dressed, and I'd run naked, of course, out of the bath. Mum would dry me and run down to the bedroom to get dressed, and my father sitting there listening to the radio in front of the fire or whatever would be saying, wacko, wacko, when I was running around naked, just staring me, basically. And it was wacko, wacky, and whacker, and people would say, do you know John Williams? Never heard of him. Do you know Whacker? Yeah, know him well.
So you've been called Whacker pretty much since the days you were running naked down the hall.
I've been called John for 63 years and Whacker for 60, Hugh. And when I won the pre-selection, Mark Vale said that nickname Whacker's got to be expunged. And I thought, well, it's a bit late in the day for that.
It's beautiful country down there. I know that bit of South Australia slightly. It's big
beautiful
sky country.
Yeah.
What was your childhood like?
I had a great childhood. We lived on the farm till I was 5 years old. Then we moved into Jamestown. And it was good there to have 240-volt electricity. I went to the local convent school there for 7 years. Many good friends, even one of my mates, Michael Kelly. We've been mates since 5 years old and we're still the best mates today. All these years later, we had a combined 21st birthday together. We played tennis together. We played football together. He was best man at my wedding and I was in his wedding party and so on. And yeah, the friendships have gone on for a lifetime.
Now, your dad, Reg, left the farm for a while, as many men did in the beginning of 1940, to go off and serve. He became, he served in what was arguably the most dangerous role available in the Second World War. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Hugh, in 1941, my father joined the army. He had 2 years in the army, but his younger brother, Don, who was about 18 months younger, joined the Air Force in the Lancaster Bombers, 460 Squadron, the All-Australian Squadron that delivered more tons of bombs and flew more missions than any other squadron in Bomber Command. And in 43, my father joined the Air Force, and he also became, they were both rear gunners in Lancaster Bombers. And I don't know if he just put his hand up to be probably one of the most dangerous jobs in the war, but I said to him one day, did you think you'd get killed? And he said, no, if I thought I was going to get killed, I wouldn't have gone. The immortal young man.
The trouble with being a tail gunner in a Lancaster bomber, as I understand it, is that if you get in trouble and you're getting shot down, other people within that aircraft have got some sort of a chance, an outside chance to bail out under a parachute. But the tail gunner is pretty much stuck in there and doomed most of the time. And also the attacks, if you're getting shot up by another plane, they tended to approach from the rear. So you're the first one to cop a shot.
Yeah, terrible situation, very dangerous, and compartments just too small to have a parachute on while you're actually flying over enemy territory, etc. So hugely dangerous job. And Hugh, the uncanny thing is my father got grounded because of ear problems. Both eardrums basically burst and he was grounded. The next mission, about 4 days later, his plane got collided over France with one of our Allied planes and all were killed. And my father was grounded back alive at base. So
his number wasn't up.
Exactly. And I've still got the letter where he wrote to his father saying, I was grounded, I'm home safe, but all my crew are reported missing.
Terrible times. You went briefly to university. You got a scholarship to go to university.
Yeah.
But you didn't like it.
Hated it, Hugh. My father sent me off to Ross River College in Adelaide. I did pretty well at school. And because we didn't have a lot of land in South Australia and land was very expensive, I was supposed to be the intelligent one and go on and do a university degree, etc. So when I matriculated, completed year 12, I won a scholarship to university and I actually demoted that to a Institute of Technology course and did part-time studies while working full-time in Adelaide. And after 3 months here, I couldn't cop the city any longer. I was missing my friends, missing my family. So Mum said, you've got to stay there for 3 months. You've got to stick it out for 3 months. And as soon as the 3 months was up, I was off with the speed of a virgin chook.
And you were back on the farm.
Back on the farm, but without a lot of land, just 1,500 acres for Mum and Dad, my brother and his family, and myself. It was a case of I spent a lot of time working off-farm, which was either shearing sheep or driving trucks, usually.
Now, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the Labor Party was famously born out of the shearers' strike in Queensland in 1891, I think it was. Were you ever tempted to the Labor side of politics?
No, I wasn't, Hugh. And I remember when I was shearing at Carowaloo Station out of Port Augusta, famous shearing shed, that's where they made the film Sunday Too Far Away. And it was January 1978, I was shearing there, and a union rep came in. He said, have you got a union ticket? I said, no, I don't have one. He said, do you want me to take it out of your wages or do you want to pay me now? I said, I don't want one. I said, we just had a state election. And Premier Don Dunstan said, unionism is not compulsory, so I don't want one. He said, you got a choice, buy a ticket or get out of the shed. Well, I was broke, we had a drought in 77, so bought the ticket, and the next shed they made me the union rep, and a new shearer came in, he said, I need a ticket. I said, mate, don't know where to get them, you have to get your own.
So you weren't a dedicated union man right from the start, despite becoming the rep.
Exactly, but I respected the unions. The unions did a great job back in the early days where workers were treated poorly. You know, when the Labor Party started under the Tree of Knowledge at Bar Cool, it was because, you know, the shearers were in terrible living conditions, not fed well. You know, their accommodation was deplorable. Their showers and toilet facilities, totally unacceptable. So they actually did a good job bringing those standards up as they should have. And then perhaps in the 70s with all the strikes and so on, in my opinion, that they overstepped the mark.
Do you think there's a place for unions now? We see a lot of people doing the gig economy. You see people, we're told, being paid very low rates of pay to do things like ride on bicycles and deliver food to people.
Yeah.
Do you think there needs to be protection and that unions are the ones to deliver it?
Well, it certainly needs to be protection. That's what awards are about. And those companies, and we've seen them through some of the franchisees, et cetera, underpaying, you know, often foreign labour university students $5, $6, $8 an hour. That is disgusting. And I've always had the belief, Hugh, a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, and everyone must be treated fairly, and those people certainly are not being treated fairly.
You came to the National Party in the end. That was where you came to Parliament. Yeah. Who are the natural constituents? Who are the people, when you get up and go through those doors, who do you see as your constituents?
Well, that's a good question, because basically, I can say anyone in regional Australia. They might be someone in an aged care facility, a nurse in a local hospital, certainly the farmers and the people working on the land, the small businessmen and women who have done it. You know, many of them do it so tough, work often long, long hours a week, 70, 80, 90 hours a week, pay themselves a small wage to get the business growing, don't have a holiday or rarely have a holiday, don't pay themselves any superannuation. It's funny, when you look back in the National Party, the Country Party, almost 100 years ago, Hugh, they probably represented the wealthy squatter, the wealthy wool grower that built the nation from our first export. Well, now, of course, we've got rural Australia, high unemployment in many areas, the average pay is lower. We've done a 180 from a wealthy squatter to now the probably poorer, less fortunate people in the country in many respects. So I think it's just a case of, if you live in the regions, we've got to be there for you.
You're listening to Sunday Extra. I'm Hugh Rimmonson, and our guest is Senator John Wacker Williams from the National Party. Wacker, without relitigating the whole thing that went on with the Commonwealth Bank, where were you financially, personally, when all of that ended, a 10-year battle with the bank?
Well, as my father would say, Hugh, I had the backside out of my pants. We made good business decisions with the assets we bought. We bought three-bedroom units in the middle of Clarke's Beach on the beachfront at Byron Bay for $220,000. 12 months later, the bank made a sell and we sold them for $240,000. They'd be worth probably $6 million today, but that's life. You move on.
I often think, as I've watched you operate in Parliament, that the Commonwealth Bank probably came to regret the way it handled that rough farmer from northern New South Wales, because you haven't really let up on them in Parliament. It's not just the Commonwealth Bank, but wherever you've seen people getting ripped off through bad advice, through shonky arrangements from financial institutions, you've been pretty keen to go after them, haven't you?
Yeah, as I said, Hugh, life's about fairness and people must be treated fairly. And when I came here, the first thing I did in January 2009, I was invited to address the storm financial victims up at Redcliffe near Brisbane, where a crazy scheme of gearing up and huge debts, and she'll be right, the stock market will keep going up and it'll pay for everything and give you a beautiful standard of living. And of course, the share market fell out of bed as far as the global financial crisis goes. We had people 65, 70, 80 years old looking like at the end of their lives, or certainly the end of their working lives, Hugh, being put out on the street.
And the sense, the risk there was never really sold to them, was it? They were told about the upside, but they never fully understood that they could lose everything.
End up a big mess and some very sad stories, a lot of tears. And I promised them I would get them a parliamentary inquiry when I met with them, which we did. Now that came the future financial advice that financial planners must abide by now, put the interest of their customer first and foremost.
Now, you've also pushed for a long time for a banking royal commission. The Prime Minister, most in the Liberal Party, didn't want it, but you were pretty insistent. In the end, you won through.
We finally got it, thanks to my colleague Barry O'Sullivan, pushed very strongly on that, Hugh. And I said for about 8 years, we need a royal commission into white-collar crime, Hugh. And of course, then came the financial planning scandal with Adele Ferguson, that I actually did the research, met with the people, and I said to them when we're sitting in their office in Sydney, they said, what should we do? And I said, if I was you, I'd give it to the media. They said, do you know someone? I said, I think I know just a person. And the rest is history, where we had 600,000 Australians written to have their financial advice reviewed, and a lot of millions of dollars of compensation. And then, of course, we go on to other issues such as the bank bill swap rate, now the AUSTRAC allegations, the life insurance industry, and we've just completed our inquiry, and I'd expect next 2 weeks that we'll report to Parliament a big inquiry into life insurance, where people are having heart attacks, their heart actually stopped beating, but they weren't getting paid because of some crazy criteria of measuring the medical illness at the time.
What is your overall sense of where we are with the financial system? You know, externally it seems to be broadly speaking, stable, more stable, certainly at times in the United States system, for example, or even the European system. So where are we? Give us a points out of 10. Where is our system?
I think we're on a big turn, Hugh, and I say that I've got a good relationship with all the bank representatives here in Parliament House. The banks are essential for everyone in this country. And back in the 70s, when I grew up in South Australia, Jamestown, Hugh, the bank manager was the most respected person in town. Sadly, that is not the case today. And I hope out of the Royal Commission, we just find any more gremlins and fix it up so we can go on in the future where the Australian public can have total confidence in our banks, in our life insurance companies, in our financial planners, you name it.
Now, whenever the next federal election is held, you won't be standing again. You're out. You're done. You've recently revealed that you have Parkinson's disease.
Yeah.
How's that affecting you at the moment, and how do you see your future? Particularly, you know, you're going to go back and live in the bush. To have a chronic progressive disease can be tough anywhere, but do you fear it may be harder to manage in regional Australia?
So far, so good, Hugh. I've got a very good neurologist, and I saw him last July, and he said, look, don't want to see you for 12 months. I'm going pretty well. I'm using some other treatments as well. But I was always leaving on the 30th of June 2020. Was never going to run again, I told the National Party Central Council that. Then we had the double dissolution that brought it forward a year. So 30th of June next year, I'll complete my 11 years here, Hugh, and just want to go home to my wife and spend the rest of my life with her and visit my children and grandkids. And I'd like to do a few things on the bucket list, and hopefully my health will stay pretty good, and I'm confident it will, to do those things with my wife until whatever happens next.
And you lost a farm, but you've bought a farm. You'll go back to a farm.
The property we bought, it's a lovely property just out of town, only a small property of 400 acres, but wonderful country, well watered. Very proud of the dozens of koalas we have in the creek and the trees and around the house, which is great as well.
Fantastic. Well, one thing about your story, it always strikes me as a kind of a Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of story of leaving the land and having a crack in Canberra and making a pretty good fist of it. What was the year that made you Whacker Williams?
Well, I left school in the end of 72, matriculated, worked very hard, studied hard, got a good result. It actually burnt me out from study, Hugh. I didn't read a book for many years until my older son, David, said, read this book called A Fortunate Life by A.B. Facey.
Fantastic book.
Magnificent book, should be compulsory reading for everyone. I think that helped me through the tough times I went through later on in life. And 73 is the year I went out into the big wide world. Tertiary studies, nah, couldn't do that. Working in the office, couldn't do that. And I went back to the bush, where I think it's a case of, you know, you can take the bloke from the bush, but you can't take the bush out of him. And all I want to do is go back to Jamestown, to country Australia. And I've been very fortunate to live then all of my life in rural Australia, which is a wonderful thing to have because the people are kind and caring. So life's been great.
Yes, as Shakespeare said, to thine own self be true. And your song is Come What May by Vicky Leandros, I think. Why this song?
Lovely song I heard in 72 when I was at college in Adelaide, and I thought, always liked it, and I thought, well, this is for my wife Nancy, my soulmate, so I hope everyone enjoys it, Hugh.
Okay, Senator John Whacker Williams, thanks for your time, and here's your song.
Thank you.
The days gone by, when I thought I was living, having fun with all the friends I knew. Now it seems all so long ago, for my life changed completely from the moment I met you. Come what may, I will love you forever, and forever my heart belongs to you. Come what may, for as long as I'm living, I'll be living only for you. Now
Vicky Leandros. She won the Eurovision Song Contest for that, Come What May, from 1972. The song chosen by Senator John Wacker Williams, our guest for the year that made me.